Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Jolly old St. Nick must be a Houston Rockets fan. He wears red and white and rides a NASA-worthy spacecraft. Ahead in Only a Game, the NBA gets back to work on the holiday. Also, the best American sports writing of 2011 and remembering the greatest athlete of all time, a deer leader who was as comfortable shooting holes in one as he was bowling perfect string. Also ahead, Only a Game put a cup to its collective ear and came up with sports stacking.
Sports stacking is basically the upstacking and downstacking of cups. There's 12 of them in a set in certain pyramids, in certain sequences, and stackers are stacking it for time.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. 'Twas the day before Christmas, and throughout the league, the rosters, quite ragtag, were fighting fatigue. The lockout had rendered some fans quite suspicious, but others said, B-ball on Christmas? Delicious! Here to preview the abbreviated 2011-2012 NBA season is Henry Abbott of ESPN's True Hoop. Henry, welcome to Only a Game.
That was fantastic.
Well, thank you very much.
Is there a big drop-off after that?
The lockout lasted 149 days, leaving teams less than a month to assemble rosters and, of course, to have training camp. Are there some teams that prepared more effectively than others?
The Oklahoma City Thunder, who happened to have, you know, a very dedicated young core of players. You know, those players got together and worked out. And actually, even during this training camp, the most precious thing to a player during training camp, when they go 12, 13, 14 days in a row, mm-hmm. is a day off. Mm-hmm. The Thunder had a day off, and the players all came into the gym, every single one of them. So that's what you want to see. If you're a fan of a team, you want to know that they are so excited about winning and winning together in training. So it's no surprise the Thunder are almost everybody's pick to win the West this year, even though they've never done that before.
All right, tell me about some teams that are especially badly prepared as the season begins.
The New Jersey Nets are in a pickle. They're trying to build a team that will look good for their arrival in Brooklyn a year from now, and they would like that team to star Deron Williams, their current point guard, and Dwight Howard, who is the starting center for the Orlando Magic. So they've been assembling a roster of assets they think the Magic would like. And now the star of that package is a young center named Brook Lopez, who recently broke the fifth metatarsal in his foot and has just had surgery. So they've got a ragtag collection of pieces they think the Magic might like, and they're going to have to take the floor with them, which might get a little ugly.
You've got quite a number of games, five, to choose from tomorrow. Which ones or one will you watch?
Well, Miami at Dallas is a rematch of the NBA Finals, and it features the team that everybody loves to hate, the Miami Heat, of course. so that one will get the big ratings. But it's preceded by Boston at New York. Boston's a very interesting story right now because they always come out of training camp incredibly finely tuned, and they're generally the best team in the league before Christmas. We don't have before Christmas in this season, but I expect Boston to be – they might be really good. So that'll be a first look at them. And then I'm a big fan. I love watching the Chicago Bulls, who will be playing in L.A. against the Lakers, who are looking like a bit of a fallen angel.
In the run-up to the regular season, a lot of attention has been focused on Los Angeles. The Clippers added Chris Paul, Chauncey Billups, and Caron Butler in the offseason, while the Lakers traded Lamar Odom for a draft pick. Is it premature to call the Clippers the better team in L.A. at this point?
It's so scary to make any predictions based on preseason performance, even scarier in this weird year of a shortened season and a shortened preseason. But look, right now the Clippers look a lot better than the Lakers. The thing about the Lakers is they have so much revenue coming from their new local TV deal. And in the years to come, they will be able to spend their way out of trouble any which way they choose to. So the Lakers aren't done, but the Lakers will be undergoing transformation. They're in the Dwight Howard race as well. So they'll retool in some way. But right now, the Lakers roster is not great, especially with Kobe Bryant nursing a wrist injury he just endured.
The Knicks signed free agent forward Tyson Chandler, who will join Carmelo Anthony and Amari Stoudemire in New York. Does the presence of this trio place the Knicks among the favorites in the East?
A lot of people think so. Tyson Chandler certainly addresses their biggest problem, which was they were a horrible defensive team last year. To my thinking, it doesn't address it nearly enough. The Knicks have their other two stars, Amari Stoudemire and Carmelo Anthony, are among the worst in the league at their respective positions playing defense. And the Knicks' wing players, their guards, are not good at defense either. So you put it all together, and Tyson Chandler has a huge job. Meanwhile, he's a guy who's had a lot of injuries in his career. Now he's going to be having bodies flying at him all night long, every night of the year. That's going to lead to lots of fouls at the very least, if not injuries.
Oklahoma City and Memphis would seem to be teams on the rise. Would you go along with that?
I would add Denver to that list, too. They've got a lot of young players after their deft handling of that trade with Carmelo Anthony last year. But, yeah, absolutely. The Grizzlies were the most exciting team to watch in last year's playoffs for me, bar none. And Oklahoma City, as I said earlier, they're everybody's pick to win the West this year.
Just because of the way things worked out with the lockout, which, of course, happened right after the Mavericks had won a championship, do they become the least appreciated NBA champion of all time?
They didn't have a good offseason of partying like you usually see where, you know, like in the NHL, you see those teams taking the Stanley Cup everywhere. They didn't get to have that kind of a deal. But now that we have actual fans going to actual arenas and watching actual basketball, I think they'll get to have a little bit of fun with that.
Henry Abbott writes about basketball for ESPN's True Hoop. Henry, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
While the Dallas Mavericks muddled through what was perhaps the least satisfying offseason an NBA champion has ever had to endure, the Miami Heat had problems of their own. The Heat's pain at being the 2011 runner-up was prolonged due to the NBA lockout, and as Phil Latzman of member station WLRN in Miami reports, the team is anxious to begin the regular season tomorrow in Dallas.
The Dallas Mavericks are NBA champions, the first title in franchise history.
The severe disappointment of the Heat's 6-game finals flameout still lingers. Dwayne Wade just can't seem to turn it off.
It comes on NBA TV a lot, too. I was watching it yesterday, and it's sad every time.
And it hurts even more, because up until a few weeks ago, Wade was watching a lot of TV and working out on his own as the NBA lockout ate up nearly the first 2 months of the season, during which the pain of the Heat's finals loss went undiminished.
I always say, man, I wish I could have did this, I could have did that. But then you look back and also you understand that it was Dallas Mavericks' time.
Head coach Eric Spoelstra, who recently received a brand new contract, says last season felt unusually lengthy.
Last year felt at times like it was 2 or 3 seasons in one with our group, with the amount that we experienced.
But the coach, whom everyone calls Spo, called it a bonding experience.
If you want to fast track learning and growing with one of your teammates, you go through adversity. And we went through enough of that last year that we certainly got to know each other, especially when it was uncomfortable.
It was particularly uncomfortable for LeBron James, who went from the toast of Cleveland to the roast of the rest of the league and its fans.
It was a tough transition, you know, coming here and, you know, going through what I went through. It was something different. So, you know, I learned from it, you know, and I'm back to who I am now.
Where he is now is in a must-win situation, with NBA title or bust dragging on his basketball resume. The Heat seemed to relish the role of bad guys last year, but LeBron hopes things could be different this time around.
I don't know if fans are going to cheer for us or boo for us or whatever the case may be. You know, I'm not asking for forgiveness or anything in that case. I don't think anything can be as bad as it was last year. We're going to come together as a team, and we're looking forward to you know, playing here in front of our fans and on the road as well.
Don't hate the Heat has become a familiar refrain in Miami. Dwayne Wade also says the team would not mind improving its image.
We have our fans. We have the ones that don't care about the Heat neither. That's fine. That's what makes road games exciting. So, you know, we look forward to going on the road, just like we did last year, to try to hear the boos and to turn them into cheers.
And says King James, even a grueling schedule packing 66 games into just 4 months won't deter him from his appointed rounds.
Man, I'm so excited to be back. I don't care if we had 66 games, 66 days. I mean, I'm happy to be back. For me personally, 8 games in 11 days, hopefully I can play in every last one of them.
First, though, LeBron and company will relive the NBA Finals on Christmas Day in Dallas and hope that it'll be a dream rather than a nightmare.
It will be a great atmosphere, and both teams are going to prepare that way. You know, and the fact that they beat us in the finals is going to add something to it, and being Christmas adds a little bit more to it as well.
And D. Wade says he wouldn't have it any other way.
That's what I want to see as a fan. So I take myself out of it. I want to see the Heat and the Mavic play on Christmas Day.
So while basketball fans outside of South Florida may continue to hate the Heat, it's apparent that some of the NBA's top players would love the opportunity to play here. Citing a desire to win a championship, Miami added free agents Shane Battier and Eddie Curry to a team that needs to win it all next June to be considered a success. For Only a Game, I'm Phil Latzman in Miami.
When Cleveland Browns quarterback Colt McCoy suffered a concussion during a game against the Pittsburgh Steelers on December 8th, nobody on the Browns sideline noticed. When he briefly left the game, his hand was examined. Nobody examined his head. As a result of that oversight, the NFL announced this week that henceforth an independently certified athletic trainer, paid by the league and approved by the Players Association, will be assigned to each team for the sole purpose of identifying hits which may have resulted in concussions. They can inform sideline personnel of their observations, though the trainers are not authorized to diagnose injuries, let alone bench injured players. Of course, the presence of somebody responsible for detecting concussions will not prevent concussions, but perhaps it will help prevent situations like the one that transpired in Pittsburgh when Colt McCoy, who is currently sidelined, was rushed back into a game he later did not remember. In the past, coaches have often claimed they thought players who'd suffered traumatic brain injuries were fine because they knew which half it was and because the players said they were fine. In fact, until very recently, the league itself and the doctors it employed denied any connection between the brain injuries players endure and problems like dementia and depression from which many ex-players have suffered. In that context, the addition of trainers assigned to monitor players for potential concussions is at least a step in the right direction. Still, there's reason for players to think in terms of protecting themselves and their futures because, in the short run, coaches will always be under pressure to employ anybody who can help them win. Cleveland Browns fullback Owen Marisic has suffered 2 concussions within the past 4 weeks, and on Tuesday, he was cleared to play. Cleveland faces the Ravens in Baltimore this afternoon. Perhaps the trainer assigned to the Browns will monitor plays during which Mr. Marisic is hit especially closely. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Different athletes prepare for the Olympics in different ways. Top British sprinter James Ellington, who has had injury problems over the past several years, is preparing by auctioning himself on eBay. The injuries prevented Ellington from qualifying for official sponsorship, so he's offering to wear on his tracksuit the brands of any companies that will help provide him with the money he needs to train for the qualifying meets. As of this week, Ellington had raised a little over $50,000 from 45 bidders, meaning that when he puts on his tracksuit, he's going to look like a race car. Now, if he can only figure out how to run like one. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the best American sports writing of 2011. But first, just under a week ago, the world was stunned by the premature death of a prodigiously talented athlete, a natural whose exploits on the links and on the lanes were as unparalleled as his understanding of pro basketball. I'm talking, of course, about the late North Korean leader Kim Jong-il, who passed away last Saturday. Joining me now to discuss Kim Jong-il, the sportsman, is Jeri Longman of the New York Times. Jeri, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
There was a vast mythology built around Kim, a.k.a. the Deer Leader, including his alleged control of the weather and other supernatural powers. He apparently bowled a perfect 300 the first time he picked up a bowling ball and shot five holes in one during his first ever round of golf. How did it come to be that sports were such an important part of his myth?
Well, there seemed to be nothing that wasn't part of his myth. I mean, my only question, though, about the five holes in one was, was it on a course with a pirate theme? Was it a putt-putt course? Was there a windmill, a lion's head, pop-up gopher? That's one of the things we never understood.
Right off the bat, we've managed to make fun of Kim, and that's not a luxury enjoyed by the citizens of North Korea. Did they buy the sports stories surrounding Kim?
I'm sure some of them did. I assume that they thought he did bowl 300. Whether the bumpers were raised on the lanes, we don't know, but I assume people do buy that.
In your Times article, you quote Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum as saying that North Korea was not a security threat to the U.S. because Kim, quote, doesn't want to die. He wants to watch NBA basketball. Given the longstanding tensions in East Asia and the domestic problems North Koreans have faced for decades, wouldn't it have been safer when Kim was watching the NBA rather than doing something else?
From everything I've heard, he really had a huge interest in the NBA. And his son, Kim Jong-un, who's now the successor, the Washington Post did a terrific story a couple of years ago talking about his brief and somewhat sketchy education in Switzerland, and he was known as a guy who spoke German, some English, but did not appear to have any sort of political aims. He spent much of his time doing meticulous pencil drawings of Michael Jordan. So it appears that, you know, in the family, that there was a huge basketball interest.
The so-called Olympic ideal asserts that head-to-head competition can and does promote peace between nations. Given the leadership's interest in sports, will North Korea's continued participation in international sporting events increase the chance that it will someday shed its rogue status and forge a common bond with other nations?
You know, that's above my pay grade. But what we do know that you know, that North and South Korea have marched together in the opening ceremonies of some Olympic Games, and FIFA, soccer's world governing body, has given North Korea permission to show the 2010 World Cup on television, even though North Korea did not have the rights. You know, I've never been to North Korea. I went to the Panmunjom Peace Village once with the United States men's soccer team before the 2002 World Cup, which was held in South Korea. One of the strangest sporting experiences I've had. So right at the border, there is no Berlin Wall-type edifice. I mean, there's no fence or anything. Once you're actually in this peace village where they have Quonset huts, where they've actually had some, you know, bilateral talks in North and South Korea. So the American players were led into the huts. And once you're in the huts, you can walk to the other end of the hut, and you're in North Korea. But they told the American players before they went in, don't be surprised, because the North Korean guards are known sometimes to put their faces in the window and hold up a finger that does not strictly signal we're number one. So, there is some of that common ground there.
Jeri Longman is a sports reporter for the New York Times, whose books include The Hurricanes, One High School Team's Homecoming After Katrina. You can link to his column about Kim Jong-il at our website, onlyagame.org. Jeri, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Every year at this time, we dip into the best American sports writing, the series Houghton Mifflin has been publishing since 1991. The 2011 edition's guest editor is Jane Levy, and the series editor, as has always been the case, is Glenn Stout, and he joins me now from Vermont Public Radio. Glenn, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks very much, Bill.
And we're also joined by Chris Jones of ESPN, the magazine. His story, Breathless, is included in the current collection. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Chris, I want to begin with you and your story, Breathless, which is about Herbert Nitsch, an athlete with whom lots of our listeners may not be familiar. Tell us a little bit about what he does.
He is a free diver, which is essentially someone who, on a single breath, dives as deep as they can into the ocean. He's basically an insane man who believes he's part fish and part seal and believes that one day we'll dive 3,000 feet into the ocean. He's gone pretty far. He's gone more than 700 feet, but he thinks he can go deeper yet.
At one point in your story, when you needed a metaphor, you dialed up the NFL to describe the pressure on Herbert Nitsch when he made a record dive. You wrote, and I'm quoting here, "The equivalent of an NFL lineman was sitting on each of his eyeballs." Was the idea to invoke a sport everybody knew in order to discuss a sport that nobody knew?
I think you're probably giving me much more credit than I deserve there. I was trying to come up with a way of saying 300 pounds without saying 300 pounds. And I think probably my own biases, I thought of super chubby football players. And sometimes these things, when you're writing late at night, who knows where it comes from.
This edition of Best American Sports Writing also features stories about skateboarding, dog handling, jumping off mountains. Are we into the age of excellent writing about fringe sports, or at least sports that are fringe compared to football, baseball, and basketball?
I'll let Glenn go first there.
Yeah, I think we're in an era where there's so many excellent writers out there that in many instances, it doesn't matter what they write about. They're going to find something interesting in it and an interesting way to put it. And sports, it seems like there's nothing new. Well, in fact, there's everything new every year.
For me, it's never been the sport that matters, but the athlete or the character, the main character in your story. I mean, someone like Herbert does not exist, as far as I know, in the National Basketball Association, but he does exist at the bottom of the ocean off Greece, you know, and so these are the places we have to go. For me, it's always the character. It's like a movie. You know, I don't necessarily subscribe to a particular genre of movie, but if there's a good character involved, then I'm willing to watch.
I don't want to talk too much about this particular athlete, but this is a guy who's figured out how to get oxygen out of about 9 different parts of his body.
The spleen was what really got me.
Yeah, he gets oxygen out of his spleen.
Yeah, the spleen is his third lung. No, he's a very strange man. For me, the part of that story that still gives me the creeps a bit is the idea of wet equalization, that your ears are the greatest limiting factor in terms of how deep we can go. You know, if you go to the bottom of a swimming pool, you can feel the pressure on your ears. And for these free divers, when they're at hundreds and hundreds of feet down, the pressure is intense. And, well, they've decided that maybe the most efficient way to combat that is to inhale water and pack it into your sinuses and your ears to offset the pressure on the outside. And Herbert's this sort of very clinical Austrian man. And I remember I said to him something like, "Well, that must feel like drowning." And he said, "Yes, it is very unpleasant." And that was for me the money quote of that whole experience.
That reminds me of a Best American Sports Writing story from many years ago where they asked this guy whose sport was lifting incredibly heavy rocks why he had failed. And his answer was, "The rock, she is very heavy."
I remember that one, Bill.
Sometimes it's a very simple answer.
Chris, you've written for Bill Simmons' Grantland, an online long-form sports magazine. I wonder if you foresee Grantland writers flooding Best American Sports Writing with candidates in the future.
Grantland's one of those great new outlets for sports writing. I think so often we've talked a lot about, you know, newspapers being in flux and are places willing to spend money to do these kinds of stories. And I'm not sure what Glenn would say, but for me it seems like I almost have too much to read these days, that there are so many outlets, that there are so many good writers that I can't possibly keep up. It used to be that I would go to Sports Illustrated or I would go to the New York Times and to get my fix of quality sports writing, and now it seems like there are, for me anyway, there are a lot more venues than there used to be. In Grantland, I think we're all hopeful is going to be one of those go-to places.
No, I'll agree, because there's just a real flowering of places where good writing can find a place to be right now. There's another site that just went up called The Classical, and there are other niche, you know, online sites that are presenting some very good writing, as well as, you know, some of the places where there's always been good writing. So, you know, it's not like I'm looking at less material or finding less material, you know. Either that or I'm reading a lot slower these days, but it seems to take more and more time each year now.
There's also a lot of bad writing out there, and I think Glenn deserves some kind of medal for having to wade through what I can only imagine is a lot of poor material. For me, it's like there's this deluge of stuff, and some of it is really, really good, and some of it is really, really bad.
That's what my wood stove is for.
The hopes of so many writers going up in smoke in Vermont. It's a beautiful picture.
There has been much to write about regarding the Los Angeles Dodgers recently, and in one story, Bill Shaken of the L.A. Times focused on a man named Vladimir Špunt, who was hired by the co-owners of the team when they were still married to each other. Glenn, tell me about the appeal of that story.
Well, the appeal of that story was its utter and total weirdness, and what it told you about this couple, the McCourts, who owned the Dodgers, who seemed to be living in their own world, oblivious to the needs of their fans or the desires of their fans. And the Vladimir Špunt story was emblematic of that, because he's this guy they hired to essentially put spells on the opposition while he watched them through television. I mean, that's total insanity. And I think it just showed up how absolutely inept they were as owners. It did not work out well for the Dodgers, and, you know, it didn't really help them win any ball games.
It was just one of those stories that, you know, we're taught growing up as writers, show, don't tell. And you could say over and over again that the McCourts were crazy, or that they wasted money, or that they destroyed the Dodgers. All you had to do was introduce them to Vladimir, and your reader says, oh, yes, no, everything that you could possibly say about these people is totally, totally true.
You like, don't have to tell me anything.
You could possibly make it. Yeah, no, I know. I have Vladimir, and I know everything. It's I don't know what you call those stories, like keyhole stories, where you look through this little window and you see the whole picture. That's one of them.
There's another story that I would like to mention, just because it seemed to me that it could have made it into a collection of writing about science as easily as it made it into this book, and that's The Tight Collar, which is David Dobbs' examination of the phenomenon of choking. Glenn, you're an old baseball pitcher. Did this essay teach you anything about choking?
It taught me why I was so terrible at it. And why during the playoffs I could never get anybody out when it mattered. You know, I really wish I would have read a story like that back when I was playing more, because there are actually a few strategies presented in it that might have been useful. I mean, he talks about how, you know, golfers, when they're putting, actually putt better if they're counting backwards while they're doing it, because they're involving their mind just enough so they're not thinking too much about what they're doing. And that's a really useful tool.
That story, I think, will hit home for a lot of amateur athletes, where I remember the best round of golf I was ever playing in my life, and I'm a terrible golfer, but one day I was touched by the hand of God, and for my first nine holes, I couldn't miss. I was playing a professional round, and my brother at the turn said something like, well, the wheels are going to come off any minute, and of course, my very next drive, I shank, and I never got it back. And that story was just about the push, that little nudge that pushes you clear off balance. That story, I thought, was just a really good meditation on how fine the line between success and failure is in sports.
Chris Jones writes for the website Grantland, and his story, Breathless, which appeared in ESPN, the magazine, was chosen for this edition of the book. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Bill, and thanks for putting me in the book, Glenn.
And Glenn Stout is the series editor of Best American Sports Writing. Glenn, thank you very much for joining me again.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game. Let's get the embarrassment and the apology out of the way early. During our presentation of the annual Only a Game gift guide last week, I somehow referred to basketball's three-point line as the charity stripe. I know the charity stripe is the foul line. What else could it be? But I goofed. And among those who noticed it was Steve Flammy, who emailed to say, "This is so very wrong." Among the many others who caught the gaffe was Eric Anderson, who charitably couched his correction in praise. "Only because I am a devoted listener, as well as a reader of your work in the Boston Globe, do I raise this quibble," he wrote. "Back in the days of the two-handed set shot, when I was playing basketball, the charity stripe was the free throw line. Was there a redesignation that got past me?" No, Mr. Anderson, nothing has gotten past you, and what a gracious man you are. Lynn Woodard, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio, was offended when Charlie Pierce and I briefly discussed the Kentucky alum and basketball fan who's also a Playboy model. The young woman's ankle was slightly injured in a melee following a game, and she missed a modeling assignment. Charlie couldn't understand why a swollen ankle would matter. "I suggest you drop Mr. Pierce from future shows," Miss Woodard wrote, "though I won't know if you do because I plan to be listening to some other station until it's time for Car Talk." Jeff Tracy of Lockport, New York, wrote to say that he was confused that in last week's program we had presented what he termed, quote, "an excellent piece on fighting in hockey and a story on Ultimate Fighting." That would have been my conversation with Matthew Polly about his new book, Tapped Out. "My point is this," Mr. Tracy wrote, "sport is good, fighting is bad. Your broadcast created a mixed message. Fighting is bad in one arena and good in another. Let's leave fighting to the Rock'em Sock'em robots." And finally, Regina Garcia responded to the interview on our Facebook page about the relocating of Albert Pujols for $250 million. "Glad my team's not stuck with that bill," she wrote. "One injury and ... Convey to us your opinions through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can mail us a postcard at Only a Game, WVUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
The notion that the NFL is the no-fun league took a hit last week, courtesy of Carolina Panthers offensive coordinator Rob Chudzinski. Figuring he could take advantage of the athleticism of rookie quarterback Cam Newton, Coach Chudzinski installed a play he'd learned by watching The Little Giants, a kid's movie. In the film, the play involved a female player, an overweight child running until he collapsed, and a tiny kid crashing into the goalpost. But the essence of the play was the old hidden ball trick, and that's the feature Coach Chudzinski adapted for the Panthers' offense. "Fine," said quarterback Newton, who empty-handed led the defense of the Houston Texans on a chase around the field while the actual ball carrier, tight end Richie Brockle, slipped into the end zone. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a sport that requires not just a cup, but a whole room full of cups. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Tomorrow, shortly after the dog eats the wrapping paper and the batteries in the electronic toys all die, the NBA season will begin. Is it fair to say the Los Angeles Clippers will enter Game 1 in an upbeat mood?
Yeah, they had a great game against the Lakers. Blake Griffin scored 30 points. Kobe Bryant's kind of injured. The Clippers are going to be the glamour team for a while, which just shows you a little bit about how the year has turned on its head.
Good news, Charlie. LeBron James is no longer the most hated player in the National Basketball Association. Who, perchance, has taken the title?
Chris Humphries has taken it for treating alleged human being, alleged non-cyborg Kim Kardashian shabbily.
Oh, no. More letters.
No, I mean, when are we going to start?
You don't think
when
she has fans out there?
When are we going to start being concerned with real people? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, LeBron James is still the most disliked real person in the NBA.
Since we last spoke, the previously winless Indianapolis Colts have won twice. I guess this is the reverse of the only a game curse.
Yeah, they've screwed up the first-round draft pick now. It's probably going to wind up going to Minnesota. They did, you know, this was supposed to be the march of the Houston Texans into the playoffs. That's been derailed for a while. And, of course, the Colts did themselves no favors by winning.
This week, former NFL players Jamal Lewis, Dorsey Levens, Fulton Kuykendall, and Ryan Stewart, all with medical problems, sued the National Football League. They claim the NFL hid knowledge of the long-term damage concussions can do. Does this seem to you to be the opening tap on a door that may soon be kicked down altogether?
It does indeed, because I think the discovery process going back before the NFL got interested in this particular issue is going to be quite fascinating.
Meanwhile, pro football's popularity seems to be secure, at least as measured by number of people watching games on television. Have you got the numerical evidence there before you?
Yeah, the Dolphins and the Cowboys racked up almost 31 million viewers. The only non-football related show to get into the top seven was CBS's Two and a Half Men, the season premiere, which wedged in there between the Patriots and the Broncos on the 18th of December. And the Patriots and the Cowboys on the 16th of October.
The college bowl season is underway. Which of the 35 matchups most thrills and or delights you?
Well, I of course, always go to the games that are played on my birthday. This year there are two. The Military Bowl, presented by Northrop Grumman, which has Air Force playing Toledo. And the Bridgepoint Education Holiday Bowl from San Diego, featuring Texas and California. I think I'll be watching the Bridgepoint Education Holiday Bowl because that's on my birthday.
Fans in Los Angeles can now breathe easy and enjoy the holiday season. Why is that?
Because Matt Barkley, the quarterback, is going to come back and play another year and collect himself a Heisman Trophy, I think.
I thought for a moment there you were going to say collect another check, and that, of course, would have been
illegal. That would have been very wrong at Southern Cal, as you know.
Sure, it doesn't happen. An investigation of more than two dozen Arizona politicians who received free tickets to the Fiesta Bowl has resulted in, well, what exactly?
Nothing. A dive by the local prosecutor. He's blaming the fact that the laws are inconsistent, the reporting requirements vague, and that there's a requirement that he has to prove that a defendant, quote, knowingly violated the law. In other words, Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery would just as soon not do his job real hard on this one.
So the laws may be inconsistent, but by golly, the politicians are consistent.
Absolutely.
You offer them free tickets.
They're going.
They take them.
They're there.
Fans of the Montreal Canadiens are planning a protest rally on January 7th. They will march outside the Bell Center and provide Quebec flags to fans. What's got them so upset?
Yes, les habitants. They have a coach who does not parle français at all.
We, on the other hand,
Lien.
Are simply brilliant at it.
Rien du français pour leur coach. Yeah, that's going to become an issue because this is the one place in the world where it would be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, the Canadians aren't very good right now, which I'm sure is exacerbating the whole thing.
On Saturday night, Colby Armstrong of the Toronto Maple Leafs took a hard hit to the head, and over the next 2 days, he hid concussion symptoms from team trainers and doctors. Now he's out indefinitely. One wonders if Mr. Armstrong has not been paying attention to the news.
Well, he's been paying attention to the news, but he's also been paying attention to the culture in which he was brought up from the time he was about 12, which is you get out and play. Until that changes, the sudden attention to head injuries is going to be a terrific thing in theory, but it's going to be very hard in practice.
The tax man cometh, or at least the Major League Baseball luxury tax man. Once again, the New York Yankees will pay the most, $13.9 million, but it's the lowest tax assessed to that team since 2003, so I guess that's good news.
Yeah, the Yankees are retooling, as we know, and they're doing it relatively on the cheap, I mean, relative to what the Yankees usually do. The Red Sox got smacked pretty hard, too, with the luxury tax. Their spending's gone up. They got a bill for $3.4 million, which is, you know, almost better than double what they paid last year.
Barry Bonds has appealed his conviction for felony obstruction. Some have said he got off easy with only 30 days of house arrest, 2 years of probation, and a $4,000 fine, but I guess not easy enough.
I'd like to commend all the drug warriors in my business and around the media for this tremendous trophy they've put up on the wall. Barry Bonds gets a slap on the wrist and decides to appeal the slap. Really well done. Well worth the $50 million it took.
The readers of Sports Illustrated weighed in with their choice of best sports moment of 2011 this week. Charlie, tell us of their choice and how you regard it.
It's the return of the football player Eric LeGrand at Rutgers a year after he was paralyzed from the neck down. And who can convey, I mean, this is an obvious vote, and I'm glad it went that way.
It's rare that actions on the sports field result in criminal charges, but this week Chelsea defender John Terry, who's also a captain of England's national soccer team, is facing criminal charges for allegedly racially abusing an opponent during a game back in October. Boy, that should get the attention of other players, I'd think.
This is a very odd and a kind of uplifting story, to be perfectly honest with you. The racial undercurrent in English soccer has been a problem for a while, both in the stands and on the field, and this may be the first step towards taking control of it a little bit.
And finally, Charlie, I understand that fans of the Bears have reason not only to hope their team will beat the Packers tomorrow, but that Chicago will shut out Green Bay. Why is that?
Because you can go to Sewickley Motors in Rochelle, Illinois, and if the Bears shut out the Packers, you get a free car.
Is Oprah running that
dealership? How'd you like to be the executive sales manager that has to open the doors on the morning after the Bears shut out the Packers?
And how much
do you think people will just show up and just start driving them off the lot?
They leave the key.
Got my ticket stub right here. I'm out.
How about the green one?
I'll take the Mitsubishi over there. Yeah, that's a good one. No. I'll take the Ferrari, the one over in the corner.
Charlie Pierce writes the politics blog for Esquire magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. Merry Christmas, and Merry Christmas to all our listeners.
At the St. Michael Center in Baltic, Connecticut, it's sports stacking time, or at least it was on a recent Saturday, and I was on hand for the 2011 Connecticut Sports Stacking Championships. What, you may ask, is sports stacking? That's precisely the question I put to Glenn Costello, the gym teacher and director in charge of the competition, while all around us scores of agile stackers practiced for their moment in the spotlight.
Sports stacking is basically the upstacking and downstacking of cups. There's 12 of them in a set in certain pyramids, in certain sequences, and stackers are stacking it for time.
Glenn Costello not only brought sports stacking to the phys ed classes he teaches in Baltic, he's also a competitor of sorts, but he's not an especially fast stacker of cups. So before it was time to watch high-level competition, I thought I'd better find a contender to show me how the game works. Enter Kaylee Diedrich, a high school senior who drove hours from New York to stack cups against the best, and she acknowledged that she's no slouch herself.
Okay, well, I think I'm not exactly sure, but I'm pretty sure I'm third officially for adult females in the world because I'm 18 now. And I know that I'm one of the best, like, adult female stackers, so.
I asked Kaylee to upstack and downstack her cups slowly in an event known as the cycle, explaining as she proceeded what she was doing.
In order right now, we have a 3, a 6, and a 3. And in order to do the cycle, you have to start off by doing the 3-6-3. That's the first part of the cycle. So you're just going to put one hand over the other and stack these up very slowly using both hands.
And when you're finished, you've got a pyramid of three.
A pyramid of three, a pyramid of six, and a pyramid of three.
Okay.
Forming the 3-6-3.
Step two?
Step two, you go back to where you started and you take them down using both hands.
And the cycle stacking continued apace through.
Now you're left with a pile of 10 in the middle. And using both hands again, you're going to form a big pyramid with four on the bottom.
Wow. It's amazing how those cups slip out and just.
Yep.
Go where they're supposed to go.
Yeah, you got to use your fingers and just slide it along and let them fall one by one. And
wow.
Then you're going to slide out again.
That was cool.
And now you're back to the 3-6-3.
If a cup slips away during that process, it's called a fumble, although one of the other stackers with whom I spoke called it a mess-up, which I liked for the informality. Anyway, fumbles must be recovered and restacked, or the stacker has committed a scratch, which means the performance doesn't count. In case you've been transfixed by the notion of cup stacking and you're about to begin searching your cabinets for stackable cups, be advised that normal cups won't work very well. I learned that from an entrepreneur named Lorraine.
Well, you need the special cups with the holes in the tops. Yes, you can't just use plastic cups from the grocery store.
Oh, right, because otherwise the air would push the cups down. And
yes.
Special.
Yes.
How much does an elite set of stacking cups cost?
The most expensive we have are $23, and that comes with a timer.
The serious competitors are serious about their cups. They carry them around in protective cases, which they wear over their shoulders like quivers. Many of these competitors first encounter each other by exchanging videos of themselves stacking. When they meet in person, the encounters can generate celebrity magic.
My son is an autograph signer now.
That's Rose Ford. She and her husband, Peter, are accompanying their 14-year-old son, Peter Jr., the fastest stacker in Rhode Island. At last year's Connecticut Championship, he out-up-stacked and down-stacked all comers from six states, so no wonder he draws autograph hounds.
He already had, like, how many?
Half a dozen, anyway.
Half a dozen, and today he's signing autographs.
People
now
coming up and saying, hey, would you sign this?
Yeah.
The little guy's first coming into the sport, you know. They
the think
these guys
thing
are great. Makes
it
us
is
proud.
I'm familiar with Little League dads and soccer moms. Before attending these championships, I'd not encountered stacker parents, and the Fords weren't the only ones. Lori and Steve Frechette's son, Tim, has been stacking cups for 3 years. Steve mentioned a benefit I'd not have imagined.
One thing that a lot of people don't realize, like Tim used to have he was chubby before he started stacking. Now he's like worked himself into shape just by doing these.
Lost 16 pounds.
16 pounds just doing cup stacking. So
lost 16 pounds doing cup stacking.
Right. It could be the next new exercise rage.
According to the experts ranging in age from 8 to 18 with whom I spoke, cup stacking has already achieved rage status in Colorado, where the competition began, and in Pennsylvania, California, Maryland, and Texas, where the most recent world championships were held last April. It's also big enough in Brooklyn to have captured the attention of Nathan Robles, who had to stand on two stair steppers just to reach the cups on the table before him. With the help of his mother, Antoinette Robles, I asked Nathan how old he was.
How old are you, my love?
Three.
Three! That Nathan is already an accomplished cup stacker is particularly surprising, since, according to Antoinette, when Nathan began, he didn't have the official cups.
No, he started with paper cups, actually, before he turned 2 years old. He was watching the YouTube videos. That's how I ended up buying him the real cups. And from then on, he's been playing the cups every single day, if he has a chance.
And even when he doesn't have the chance, such as when Nathan is supposed to be eating breakfast.
And sometimes he even stacks other things, like even his food, sometimes the cereals. He would stack them like the little...
Like Cheerios?
The Cheerios. He would stack them one on top of the other. I don't know how his brain is wired.
For the record, Nathan's brain is wired well enough for him to have brought a first-place medal home to Brooklyn. Nobody else under five came close to his times. Given the 3-year-old stacking phenom, the 14-year-old autograph signer, and the cacophony of cups to which you've been treated for the past several minutes, you might be inclined to conclude that there's nothing solemn about this pursuit. If so, you'd be wrong. The entire day's clackety-pop of cup stacks rapidly growing and shrinking was merely a prelude to the stack of champions, during which the entire room went silent as one at a time the best stackers attempted to break various world records. Among them was Michael McCoy of Pearl River, New York. That day at the St. Michael Center, the applause told it all. Mike McCoy had established a new world record in the very event I'd learned about from Kaylee Diedrich, the cycle. I worked my way through a throng of reporters and broadcasters to secure the coveted interview with him.
I thought I had a chance, but I didn't think I would actually get it.
You look pretty happy when it happened.
Yeah.
All right. How old are you?
15.
And what's next?
I don't know.
You're supposed to say Disney World. I'm going to Disney World, right?
Yeah, I'm going to Disney World.
Okay. Cooperative young man, that Mike McCoy. Maybe Disneyland, maybe not, but he's going places. Joyous, jolly, merry, happy, let me not become too sappy, as I herein now intend warmest wishes to extend for a holiday so bright that all your games come out just right. May the basketball not knock from the shelf your favorite clock. No one wants to see a rift caused by someone's bouncing gift. May the family gathered round the table never hear the sound of sour louts who loudly claim they only want to watch the game. But if you're inclined to watch, may your favorites never botch their chances. Be they proud or humble, may they never foul or fumble. And if you're a baseball fan, and your team's done all it can to hold in place its biggest heroes, writing checks with lots of zeros, let us hope with every ounce of hope we have the checks won't bounce. Time will not allow reports pertaining to the other sports, but don't assume that we don't care because your favorite game's not there. May the gifts o'erflow your locker, whether it is golf or soccer, tennis, bowling, cards, or darts, that warms the cockles of your hearts. Season's greetings, all the same, from us to you, only a game. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Sam Sanders at Vermont Public Radio, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view my sports stacking photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Rose Ford, mother of competitive cup stacker Peter Ford. I asked Mrs. Ford if it was possible to outgrow stacking.
Hey, I love to color and I'm 42.
Well, that must explain all the pink and purple cups with the pictures of sparkly rainbows and shiny unicorns on them. And hey, are those stickers? Wow. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.